When are you gonna get it through your thick skull, princess? You're my girl.
Tim, I'd never be your girl, even if you had $1 million.
Yes, you will! I'm gonna marry you someday, princess! Someday you'll be my wife!
Josh, it finally happened.
What?
I swore forever that I was not going to binge watch The Office on Netflix, but I needed something to settle myself and to sleep every night, and I started binge watching The Office at night.
Okay. That sounds like me back when I had my first apartment. All I would ever do was just watch seasons of The Office over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But that was before I had a Netflix subscription, so I was DVDing it up.
See,
really bad.
I cannot get rid of my DVDs of The Office because the deleted scenes have so many good bits in them, and the bloopers are good. The behind the scenes stuff's great on that show. I mean, even with Netflix, I won't get rid of my discs.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you?
I'm on season 8 right now. I don't even really remember when I started, but it's the first time I've rewatched season 8 since it was on TV because I just greatly disliked it. And now I'm just like, this is like bad but tolerable.
Right,
it's like a Call of Duty installment. It's like, all right, I just got to get through this
until the next one comes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about them redoing it?
They still haven't officially said they're gonna. So I'm just like hoping that somebody lets that idea die, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, they're bringing Murphy Brown back. So,
well, I mean, come on. When you think of the pinnacle of TV.
Mm-hmm. Murphy Brown.
I mean, it's right next to Seinfeld.
Speaking of the dangers of flirting with the past.
Yes, with that, welcome to A Cast of the Past, where best friends get together to talk about old games in a new light. As always, this is Josh.
And Tom.
So the first game we ever talked about had an ending that just left everybody kind of on their own to figure out and see, you know, what happened to it. What do you think happened at the end of this game? What's your story? What do you think's going on? All this stuff.
Yep. And
what are the odds that we're going to run into this again?
I guess pretty good when we're talking about indie titles.
Yeah.
We got some fun little feedback from our fans with Limbo. Our good buddy Alex commented with his own little interpretation of the ending. We got a huge Twitter reply about not so much the ending of Limbo, but the ending of Inside. We set ourselves up to receive lots of interpretations when choosing to talk about Limbo, and I can only imagine we're going to get as many with this title.
Mm-hmm. This week we are talking about 2008's Braid.
An indie game that
is based on a hairstyle.
Yes. I mean,
right?
we never thought the hair genre would explode the way it did, but Braid was a benchmark.
Man, you had that, you go from Braid, and then you go Cookin' Mama, and then, man, it's just taken off.
Mm-hmm. The Cornrow Saga? I'm still shook by that. But for reals, Braid was an explosion that kind of started, like, when we talked about how the Summer of Arcade was responsible for launching dozens of indies, but Braid was part of the inaugural Summer of Arcade, and it was such a huge success that it was like, you know, the shot heard around the world in terms of the indie games we were going to get.
Yeah.
This predates Limbo. This predates Super Meat Boy. It launched alongside Castle Crashers, you know? So, just to give you some perspective on how early it was, 10 years old as of us recording, it's a decade old.
Yeah, and then one thing I was a little shocked about when I was doing a little bit more research for the nitty-gritty of this. The entire mm-hmm. game was made by one person.
Yeah, it was. You see that every once in a while with titles like Stardew Valley, you know, just a one-man band running the whole show.
I mean, it doesn't mean that he didn't have any help. I know we had some composers come in, some artists come in and stuff, but when it came to actually developing the game and designing the game and how it worked out, mm-hmm. Jonathan Blow goes ahead and pretty much starts the beginning of the indie game movement.
Mm-hmm. So, before we gush any further, Josh, do you want to give us the nitty-gritty?
Sure. Like we talked about here, it was a part of the Xbox Live Arcade service. It launched in August 6, 2008, later to be released on Windows, PlayStation, Linux, pretty much everywhere else other than mobile devices. The developers were Number None, which actually created one of my most recent favorite indie titles, The Witness, also made by Jonathan Blow as well.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of diving in here, it is a puzzle platformer, single player mode. Kind of resembles like Mario and stuff like that, but there's a lot more into it rather than just a side-scrolling, you know, jump on the enemies and kill them type game.
No, it subverts that type of game while being starkly similar to it. And we can get into that. So yeah, it's a decade old and it's had a huge impact. And I think the three things that you could talk about with this game that are so impressive are its mechanics, its atmosphere and style, and the interpretations that you can get out of it. And we're going to hit all those today because there are opinions amongst us.
Video games strike an opinionated debate?
Yes, because only one of us can be right, and it will only be the person speaking. Because
of course, yes.
Yes.
Or the person typing on the other end of this.
Yeah, yeah. That person is always right.
Yes.
Yes. So, Josh, let me get into why I'm right first. So, the mechanics of Braid are really interesting. As you said, you start every level, you're running left to right, and you're jumping on bad guys, similar to Mario. And so Tim traverses these levels that are designed in a kind of way that evoke Van Gogh paintings. The splash screen on the Xbox looks like a daytime version of Starry Night. I'm not going to pretend I remember a lot of art history, but it just evokes that style just looking at it. And you jump on some enemies that look like Goombas, but they're distinctively not Goombas. And, you know, you'll fight a boss every once in a while and you'll get to the end of the level. And what's at the end of each world's important in drawing out the Mario comparisons, because Tim, in his quest through all these mythical worlds, is looking for a princess. And every time he gets to the end of a level, he comes upon a castle and a little dinosaur comes out and he goes, he says some kind of variation on, "Your princess is in another castle." And it's just, of course, you know, you're like, I understood that reference. So that all sounds kind of just plain Jane. You know, what's so remarkable about this? I think the big hook that makes all of that interesting is as you play through these levels, you have the ability to rewind or in some instances fast forward time. And it's this mechanic that plays into the puzzle solving aspect of this game. Because you can just walk from left to right and make it through most of these worlds, with the most amount of effort being to beat the boss. But littered throughout every level are puzzle pieces that, when all collected, put together a portrait in each level. And the portrait gives you key narrative details. But the only way to get these puzzle pieces are to solve challenges based around manipulating time. Whether it's defeating enemies in a certain kind of temporal order, so to speak, or maneuvering platforms and timing lever pulls while rewinding and fast-forwarding time. And the mechanics just increase as the game go on, but they're all built around you controlling the flow of time. And it is intricate and maddening at the same time. I really have to say that.
Yep.
So, Josh, with all that laid out, what do you think about this game in both its presentation and gameplay? How do you feel about Braid?
So, I'm trying to figure out a way to put this into words, because I remember buying this game because everyone kept saying how amazing it was. It was a great indie title. It wasn't going to be a really long game. It's very platformy, but also puzzle-based. And I was like, okay, like, it has my interest. I watched a trailer to it. I really thought the art style was great to the game. After I beat this game, it was one of those, like, earth-shattering moments where I kind of sat down and was like, oh my god, this is art.
Hmm.
This is the first time that I, like, looked at a video game as art. Or looked at it other than just, like, a basic, like, cut and dry, like, story-based game where it, like, unlocked something in my brain that I was just like, what is going on right now? Like, I have to immediately go back and replay this game right now because I feel like I've missed so much playing games. And I think ever since then, like, is where I've become more like, I gotta go over here and look at this thing. I gotta go over here and read this. And how does this go into play? And how does this happen? And it's like, it kind of just, like, made me a more mature gamer.
Hmm. It challenged you to go deeper into the things instead of just playing them and then being like, okay, that was fun, and then...
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The game starts off and there's text on the screen, and it says, Tim is off on a search to rescue the princess. Mm-hmm. She has been snatched by a horrible and evil monster. This happened because Tim made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when you get done with this game, you are left to pretty much figure out what was the mistake. What did Tim do? What happened here? How did we get from point A to point B? Who is the bad guy in this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that informs, like, the richest part of the experience of this game for me is sitting down and kind of going over what Jonathan Blow was getting at. So I want to ask you real quick. It seems maybe a bit abrupt, but can we talk about the ending right up front? Or do you want to go world by world?
I want to go world by world because I feel like there's such a buildup to the end.
Okay. So let me...
I don't want to kind of just give it to the people. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You guys want to know what the ending is? Skip ahead.
We can put a time code
because,
in. Yeah.
Because this game starts in World 2.
Boom. Okay. So how about this, Josh? Why don't I try to cliff note these as succinctly as I can to move us forward while also leaving some space to generate some discussion, you know?
I would like that.
All right. Let me... get out my handy dandy notebook. I'm using a phone because who uses pens and paper?
I use pens and paper.
You are a barbarian. Okay. So we're going to talk about the narrative of Braid chronologically real quick to build up to the ending. And then when Josh and I suss out the details of our interpretations, it'll probably be a little easier to go through for you, the person with earbuds on right now. So... from the title screen, you enter a house, and the house is kind of like the hub world to all the individual levels. And you start in a room that indicates this is World 2, and you're like, wait, was the title screen World 1? That's kind of odd. But whatever, you roll with it. So World 2, it's this kind of sunny meadow level where each stage introduces a new aspect of the time travel mechanics. But the important thing to note going forward is that each world is kind of built around a central philosophical idea that's presented when you enter it. You open these books that Tim passes before you go into the first level's door, and they give you some backstory on Tim and Tim's history with the princess he's trying to save, and they put forward some themes about, you know, history, personal identity, the flow of time, things like that. So the text in World 2 basically surmises the idea that what if we could just brush our mistakes away instead of having to confront them? You know, like, it's this idea that, like, our mistakes are held over our head in such a way that keep us from growing when we should just be able to, you know, put our mistakes in the past and move forward. And so that impacts upon World 2 introducing you to the concept of rewinding time. You know what I mean? Like, all your mistakes can be erased because you can just hold X down and not die and then try a puzzle again or try jumping on an enemy the right way again. So that sets the standard for how each level is going to go. You're presented with an idea, the game gives you a mechanic that ties into that idea, and you have to use that to get through the next level.
Correct. And when I started playing World 2 with the rewind mechanic, I was thinking, okay, so this is a platformer very similar to Mario, but it has the Prince of Persia mechanics to it of rewinding time.
It's peanut butter and chocolate, you know? Put two good things together. So World 3, the new gimmick is through the text, we kind of get this sense that Tim had been in a relationship with someone that he didn't feel appreciated him. He felt like he was being held back. And so he left this person and he was convinced that he was freeing himself. And so as you progress through World 3, the concept of certain objects being held in place in time is introduced. So, like, you need to feed an enemy, but when you rewind time, the enemy is not affected by the flow of reversing time. He'll still move the same way that you can move while everything else is being rewound. So that presents challenges based around that, you know, like how do I defeat this enemy even though he can bend the rules of time just like I can. And so that's World 3. World 4, the intro, it's Tim reminiscing on how he had kind of a tense relationship with his parents. They fought a lot. And when he got to college, he figured, like, I'm free from my family. But he wasn't really free because once he got to college, he was forced to confront his insecurities and his social awkwardness on his own. So he moved from one period of personal struggle to another period of personal struggle. But he's convinced himself that, like, it's all going to be okay because his quest to find the princess will kind of justify all the struggles he's gone through. That's what...
And it's really weird because World 4...
Mm-hmm.
Ending game, I hated this world so much.
World 4 is where I began to get frustrated with this game. I don't want to sidetrack this too much, but just, yeah, World 4 has some of the most maddening puzzles in it.
Mm-hmm.
So after the setup for Tim's past, we're introduced to the mechanic of World 4, and that is that whenever Tim moves backwards, time reverses. So you have to keep moving forward if you want all the platforms and enemies and everything to obey the laws of time. But the second you start running to the left, like trying to go back to check on a puzzle or go back to grab an item, everything will reverse and go back to its original spot. So if you kill an enemy running right and then start running left, the enemy's back alive because you reverse the flow of time that way. And it's maddening.
And Tom, it's one of those things where a lot of us growing up, and still growing up to this day, we feel like we have an idea in our head and we're going to go and pursue this dream or this idea or this thought process. And you got an idea and you're going forward. And then something happens and then you end up taking a step back and you take two steps forward and then you take three steps back and then you take two steps forward. And then you take four steps back. And it's one of those things that are it playing through it. After I beat the game and realized like it just unlocked something to me, it was one of those things where I was just like, oh my God, like this is like such a huge metaphor for just life and growing up.
Mm-hmm. So again, it's a nice melding of the ideas the game's toying with and the mechanics, you know, all baked together into a nice little pie. So World 5, the intro sets up that Tim's with a romantic partner. But she's not identified as the princess, which I thought is interesting. It's like he's with someone, and later in the intro, the princess is referred to as kind of like a separate entity. So Tim's with somebody who's not the princess, but he doesn't feel like this somebody fully appreciates him. The princess is still kind of what he's seeking, and one day he's like, okay, I've got to stop doing what I'm doing and get back on track towards finding the princess. So he's moving forward again, but he clearly took some time to stay behind and handle some business.
Right. So how you mention the princess being in the background, kind of like a shadow, mm-hmm. you know, in the back of his mind, this world actually has you create this shadow figure to actually help you finish these puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like there's a part of you missing while you're trying to advance in this world. And it's just really weird how all these things kind of just, the story matches with what the gameplay is telling you, which matches what can happen in the real world. And it's all kind of, it's just crazy.
It's very interesting, very intricate. So the intro to World 6, it talks about this ring that Tim carries with him. And this ring, you know, it's a real source of trouble for Tim. He finds that people look at him different when he's got the ring around, you know, like they're not as willing to engage with him. And he doesn't like this, so he decides to put the ring away to, like, get rid of it because it's impeding his ability to get anything done. And then the levels of World 6 introduce this new mechanic where if you press Y, you're enveloped in a ring that makes Tim move in slow motion, independent of the rest of the world. So, again, it's in the story, Tim's got this ring, and it slows him down. And in gameplay, whenever you hit Y, you're enveloped in a ring that slows you down. And that plays into puzzles where you have to move slower than certain platforms or enemies and such and such. And, you know, again, it's the game doing a good job. So, Worlds 2 through 6, those are the main meat and potato puzzles of the game. And if you get every single jigsaw piece that's hidden throughout the levels, you unlock the final level, World 1. What?
You climb that long, long staircase.
Mm-hmm. The infinite staircase to World 1. So we didn't skip World 1. We hadn't been there yet. And
so it's like we have to go back to where the game began.
Mm-hmm.
Where the story begins.
The end is the beginning is the end.
As some would say.
Mm-hmm. So World 1 is not really heavy on the hardcore puzzle mechanics. There's no jigsaw pieces hidden throughout the levels. You just solve a couple jumping challenges to get through some doors, and then you finally find the princess. And
well, let's talk about World 1 really quick here. Because with everything in this game, it all has an idea and a theme of how it's going on. Whether it's you move forward and time goes forward, you move back and time goes backwards. Whether you have this ring where you move slower and everything else kind of moves fast around you, or so on and so on. But about World 1, in this world, there's really no gimmicks. It's just everything is moving backwards and you are moving forwards. And that's it. So you get towards the end and then you finally see your princess. And she's actually being lowered down on this rope or something like that by this really muscular guy. And the captions that are actually being said between the two characters, which you don't really have any dialogue in this game at all, which is the princess running away and jumping up onto this platform. And the big muscular guy says, "Come down here." And she's screaming, "Help."
So we, the player playing as Tim, go, "Ah, here's the princess. And this big bulky knight dude has taken her. So we need to help her," because that's what Tim's been doing this whole time, right? So this starts a level where you are trying to outrun like a wall of lava, kind of. And the princess is at the top on an upper platform, and you, Tim, are on a lower platform. And you're running kind of concurrently through the stage. Tim's jumping over pits and maneuvering through doors, kind of like, you know, through some traps. And the princess is on the upper level, and every once in a while, like, she'll flip a switch that'll activate something on the lower level related to you. And you guys book it together, and eventually your paths converge at the end of the level. The princess runs up into a tower, and you run up this little kind of like a side platform on the side of the tower, a little like kind of a sneaking spot up to the tower. And once you get there, everything changes. Time reverses, but not of your own choice. And it's hard to say reverse because it's more like time corrects itself. Because the princess starts running away again, and you go back over this entire course where the princess is back up top and you're back down bottom, but it's no longer you're running together, it's a chase. Every time the princess gets to one of these pieces of the level, like a trap or something, her actions go from like she's pulling a lever to help Tim, she's pulling a lever to trying to keep Tim at bay. And you get all the way back to the start, and it repeats the scene with the knight and the princess. And Josh, the captions you said now take on a whole new meaning.
Now the captions are backwards, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. the princess is screaming help and the knight is yelling, "Come down here."
Yeah.
She jumps into his arms and he carries her away from the horrible creature that is following her.
Tim.
And when that happened, it was like you could like take a camera, zoom inside my head, and it was just like,
it's a pretty incredible moment. So yeah, that informs the ending of the game. Tim's been pursuing this princess through all these worlds, and through these texts, convincing himself that I'm out to free her, to rescue her. But when we get to the end of this quest, the princess not only doesn't want anything to do with Tim, but she is terrified of him and needs to be saved from him. So this mistake that you, Josh, mentioned all the way in the beginning, that set up at the beginning of the game, Tim made a mistake. Whatever this mistake was, you know, hefty enough to make this woman deathly afraid of Tim. And
right.
That's just shocking when you think about it, what it could be. Like, it's unsettling.
Right.
And then we get to the epilogue of the game, which is Tim just kind of running back through the kind of dreamscape and opening more books, reading about them. And it's a very interesting collection of text-based like thoughts and ideas. You get a bit of text that seems to imply that the knight and the princess departed. They're not really a knight and a princess. They're just your average Joe guy and gal taking the subway home in New York. You know, they flee from Tim on a subway train to go kind of find happiness together. And then you get some bits about Tim being a scientist who experimented on animals kind of maliciously. And then you get a passage that seems to imply Tim was a scientist on something much grander, but something a little deadly in of itself. And then it just kind of ends on this note of, it's a little discomforting, but like it just ends on this note of Tim, you know, not really being complete. And that's where the game leaves you. It's discomforting. And like you said, like when you said, like, you know, it's a game that challenged you, you know, like it, when you sit there and you kind of think about everything you've seen and where the game tells you the main character's left at, it's kind of like, huh, so what was the meaning of this journey? And that's where Braid comes to a close.
And now one thing I want to add, though, because we talk about the epilogue, did you find the hidden books in the epilogue?
I opened every book and explored every nook and cranny. Would you like to just elaborate?
So there was actually a group of hidden books scattered throughout the level, kind of hidden behind bushes and stuff like that, that actually showed the same situation of what Tim was going through, but from the princess's perspective.
Okay, do you want to just elaborate on those for our audience so that we make sure we cover everything before we get into interpretations?
Yep. So pretty much what the perspective was is like Tim was going through these changes and trying to, you know, do this stuff for the princess. On the princess's side, it was showing how horrible Tim was actually being to her. And I would like, you know, let the viewers out there kind of find the videos on YouTube or go and play for yourself to find them, because it goes into a little bit more detail of the backstory to this game. And it's a little discomforting when you find out pretty much you are the evil monster that you are out to find in the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting in that I think the completed jigsaw puzzles also paint a picture of that. Do you want to talk about those really quick? Because they're, I think, important keys to understanding what this game's getting at.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the first one that we have from World 2, I believe they're going to be showing Tim in the pictures themselves.
I took them all to be Tim, personally.
Yeah. So it looks like the first one, he is laying on top of somebody as he's grabbing a glass of wine or something like that.
Well, yes, specifically though, he's the glass of wine he's reaching for, he's knocking over a bottle in the process. So right. Remember how we said World 2 is about, oh, if only we could erase mistakes. The mechanic is time travel lets you erase mistakes. The picture is it's Tim breaking a bottle while he's engaged in some kind of intimate interaction with somebody. I gotta say he's laying on top of a female looking arm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, you know, sexual in its implication, but if you look at it, I don't entirely get the sense that, I don't know, the way that the female arm is on him, it's like extending from below the frame, and I can't tell if it's a push or a grip, but it seems like it's got some force behind it. And the fact that Tim's also breaking like a bottle of wine in the process, the whole thing looks a little, you know, a little concerning.
Right. And it's one of those things. This is, like we talked about, this is an indie game that's pretty much open to interpretation. So you look at the picture. They always say a picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, we got 5 pictures here. Mm-hmm. So we got about at least 5,000 words worth to talk about.
Yes, indeed. So World 3, the second jigsaw puzzle, it's Tim. Again, I'm just assuming it's Tim in all the paintings, but it's Tim in a suit at a dinner table, and it looks like it's some kind of like gathering because he's at a dinner table and he's joining everybody in a toast. He's holding up a glass, but he looks a little out of it. You know, he looks a little spaced out.
Mm-hmm.
Then we move into World 4's jigsaw puzzle. It's a picture of Tim entering what looks to be like a bedroom filled with like children's toys. So we mentioned World 4, it's about looking back to your past. So is this Tim coming back to his childhood bedroom for the first time in a while? I right. would argue strongly, probably. So World 5, it's a portrait of Tim sitting on a couch alone drinking from like a red party cup. And he's looking over his shoulder kind of annoyed because behind him, behind the couch, there's like a big gathering of people. And you kind of see like the form of a woman close to the edge of the frame. So he's like annoyed. He's drinking alone and he doesn't seem too happy that like everyone else is having fun. And then the final one, we mentioned that the setup for the level of World 6 is that Tim has this ring, but people don't really talk to him when he's wearing the ring. They give him like these odd approaches. So it's a portrait of him throwing the ring at a dumpster. So over the course of 5 paintings, we get this sense of Tim visually, and it all of them kind of raise red flags to one degree or another. I don't know. How about you?
I totally agree, because we talk about the game. Tim is off on a search to rescue a princess. It seems like all of this is in Tim's mind, because everything that's portrayed in these 5 photos doesn't show Tim in a good place.
Mm-mm.
So in Tim's mind, I feel like he's trying to do something good after his life hasn't really been the way he wanted it to be.
Mm.
Which is very depressing.
Yes. It's a little too real.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that is a generous setup. I really would like to hear, Josh, when all said and done, what do you think the purpose of Tim's journey was? What do you think the ending brought him to? And how do you think this all comes together?
So throughout the text in the game, there's very, very subtle hints that Tim was working on something in his personal life or at his job that caused a lot of discomfort for his personal life and in the life of pretty much everybody else in the world. Throughout the game, the pictures really show that Tim was not in a great state of mind. And I feel like what happens in this game is him trying to fix everything that's happened in his personal life by kind of going inside of his brain. In the game itself, towards the end, there is a line. There's a quote from one of the books that says, "Now we are all sons of bitches." And that's actually taken from the detonation of the first atomic bomb. It's a famous quote.
Mm-hmm.
So, did Tim create the atomic bomb?
Do you think Tim created the atomic bomb?
I think he did. And the reason I think he did is because inside this game, there are hidden stars throughout the entire game. If you collect all of the hidden stars, there's something that happens at the end of the game. The final star is actually in the princess at the end of the game when she's running back to her house.
Mm-hmm.
When she goes to drop a chandelier, you're actually supposed to reverse time, or you're supposed to run backwards, or it's a certain way that you're jumping, and you jump up at her, and she actually turns into the last star that you need. When she goes to turn into the star, she blows up.
Hmm.
You get the last star, and then the game's over. You are left on the last screen, and you have to figure out what's going on. How do you get out of here? So you go back all the way up to the house. You can actually go through the house then. You go all the way to the end, and there's a door where was hidden that you couldn't actually get into it. Because I don't know if you remember, when you get to that final world, there's a door up in the top left corner, and you can't reach that door. So you go through the door, and you come out and you appear at the main screen of the game again on the city skyline.
Mm-hmm.
The city skyline is in flames. When you walk over towards going into the door where World 2 is at, up in the sky, there's a group of constellations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an outline of a man falling. So I feel like Tim created the atomic bomb, detonated it, and this is the fall of him. It has turned everyone against him. His love, the love of his life, completely running away, calling him a monster. You talk about the ring. You know, maybe he was going to propose to her, but now every time he holds on to it, he's reminded of how much of a monster he actually is. That he moves slow, but the world is still going on around him. It feels like it's pulling them down. Mm-hmm. It's a very heavy story inside this game, and the themes are pretty crazy. And when I finished this, and I sat there, and I was like, whoa, what? Like, I had to go back and replay, because I felt like there was so much that I was missing. And the more that I kept playing this game, it was just like, oh my god, like this and this, and could this be interpreted this way, and so on. Now, there's no one particular way to play this game and get a story. Everyone can play it and come up with an idea of their own, but that's my mindset of Tim, create the first atomic bomb, set it off. That was the fall of him. Everyone's afraid of him. He's a monster. Credits. What do you think, Tom?
Well, all right, I'm just going to out myself as a poor researcher really quick. I thought I had beaten this game. I didn't know about the stars. So let me just say this. My interpretation is just informed by the fact that I didn't get the stars. I thought I had everything done. I will say that I was made aware of the atomic bomb theory in doing my research. And I got to say, I felt like it was a bunch of nonsense. Until, you know, until you reveal that, and while he revealed that, I'm on my phone right here going through Wikipedia, I'm like, oh, there were stars,
But that's the thing, as a normal playthrough, your first playthrough, you didn't even think about the stars.
Well, I was just focused on I didn't see them, I was focused on the jigsaw pieces and everything, right. So, all right, let me just say this, I came away with this just with an idea that this was a critique of a kind of certain degree of toxic, you know, masculinity, and just bad attitudes that can manifest in people, and if you don't iron them out, it's going to kind of ruin you for life. I took the kind of, my interpretation of the story was Tim's mistake was that he was emotionally, maybe to a degree physically abusive on the princess, and he was actively cheating on her, because there's a thing where it's like, oh, he's with a girl that doesn't really understand him, but soon he's going to go back to the princess, you know? And mm-hmm. when they bring the ring into it, it's like, oh, when people see him with the ring, they're uneasy about talking to him. It's like, when women see him wearing a ring, maybe he's married, maybe it's some kind of promise ring or something, but when they see him with the ring, they're like, oh, you're with somebody, so I'm a little uneasy about talking to you. So he removes the ring because he's like, I'm still trying to cheat, so I got to, you know, stop wearing this ring when I go out.
Right.
You know, and I just took it like that. It's supposed to be this kind of condemnation of, you know, assholes. And, you know, when the whole, all the science stuff kind of got brought in, I was like, why are you bringing all this into it? Like, what's his career choice have to do with it? And then when, you know, the atomic bomb stuff got brought in, which I did do some research into, like, where the "now we're all sons of bitches" quote came from. I'm like, why is this being thrown in here at the last second? Like, what's going on? So, right. All right, I guess the game did go through a little bit more effort to justify the atomic bomb allegory. And I, not being as astute as I thought I was, did not get on that. And I'll just cop to that. But, yeah, huh, interesting.
It kind of brings a whole new light to the phrase that monster, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but then I think that puts more of a definitive cap on just what it's supposed to be, you know? Mm-hmm. I just feel like that just now becomes like the interpretation, like, yeah, it's about the emotionally distant and abusive guy who made the atomic bomb and treated his girl like crap in the process of his work life, and now he's got the death of hundreds of thousands of people and his failed relationship on his conscience,
right?
You know, like you said, it all comes together, and
the downfall of man.
Yeah, well then, do you want to talk about Jonathan Blow really quick while we're still on interpretations? Because
yes, because this was not the downfall of him.
No, but I just want to. So earlier this year, the AV Club wrote an article about Braid where they talked about it on its 10-year anniversary. And since we're talking about the interpretations of the ending, I kind of want to talk about the way Jonathan Blow talks about this game. And I want to just say this as professionally as possible, but so the article interviews him for a bit and it talks about people's interpretations of the game, and Jonathan Blow's comment about people interpreting the game is he says, most people who want to talk about games don't really know what they're talking about. And there's even more quotes from him in this article where I want to say this again. Just I'm not trying to editorialize this. I'm just going to say this straight up. Jonathan Blow talks, at least in this interview, with a degree of the kind of pompousness that Tim rationalizes his own thoughts with in the game. Like, just for an example, in towards the opening of the interview about Braid, quote, when I asked its famously altruistic creator, Jonathan Blow, if he was proud of it, he balked. This is one of those human psychology things I don't understand, he said. Am I proud of the game? I don't know what that means. There's something very egotistical about being proud of something. Proud sort of implies that you believe that it reinforces your intrinsic value as a person. Eventually, he relented. It was time well spent, and I'm glad that people enjoy the game. Like, that's a very Tim answer, you know?
Yeah.
If the text in the game are any indication, you know, that's the kind of thing Tim would say.
Right, right.
So, Jonathan Blow doesn't care what your interpretation of the game is, you know what I mean?
I don't know. Because that's the same way, like I said, I've played his follow-up game, The Witness. Mm-hmm. And it's another one of those games where, and we might talk about that later down the road here, it's still kind of fresh out there in the world, but it's one of those games where you interpret it your own way.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to Myst. Do you remember the game Myst?
Oh, yeah.
That did have a story in it, but at the same time, before you got to where the story actually was going, you pretty much figured out your own story as you're playing through. So it seems like that's the way with a lot of indie titles, mm-hmm. and a lot of indie developers. I know one of the most notorious creators when it comes to this kind of mindset is Phil Fish, creator of the game Fez.
Okay.
I don't know if he, you know, is proud of the work that he's done or if he doesn't think that people understand what's coming from it. But I thought it's a fantastic game. Like, I applaud him for putting all this time and all this effort in. I mean, yeah. If he thinks that I don't know what I'm talking about, by all means, call me out on it. It's cool. Whatever.
Well, he had a reputation around Braid's release for going on internet websites and forum and getting into it with people who were trying to interpret it. And this AV Club article quotes him as saying, maybe the story of Braid is too subtle or obscure. Its meaning is very, very complicated. So complicated that there's not much hope of anyone else ever having the same reading of the story. And, like, it's weird because, like, okay, I had a different read on it, and then you outlined all the content that is specifically put into the game, and now I'm like, oh, this game does have a message and an idea, and it's very straight-laced and laid forward. Like, I'll just be straight with you, Josh. Like, I came into this ready to say some things about how I thought any indication towards, like, the scientist angle, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. But now that you've revealed that those parts of the game to me, I'm like, oh, so this is the message of the game. And I accept that, and I think it's interesting. So I don't know. I think Braid is what it is, and it's a good, like, it's good, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. I mean, so good that, I mean, it's sitting on Metacritic right now at a 93%.
Deserves it. Totally deserves it.
I mean, the reception to this game was outstanding. I think the lowest score that it got was from IGN. It was sitting at like an 8.8.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's the lowest score that this game has gotten. Everything has been above, up to 10s, perfect scores all across the board. And, you know, to get a really high score on Metacritic or anything is really hard to do. And the fact that this has been sitting there for over 10 years now at the time of this recording, mm-hmm. like,
can bravo. I say, yeah. And like I said, it earns every bit of it. The music in this game, one of the best soundtracks I've ever heard in my life. I absolutely could just chill out for hours to the kind of Celtic inspired violin work in the in World 2. You know what I mean? Like that just soundtrack that carries you through that whole level. And then it gets kind of darker and more menacing as you go through, but it's still just gorgeous. It's such a gorgeous soundtrack.
And I was surprised when I found out that a lot of the music was licensed.
Well, there is in World 4, it's a music box version of it's like, you know, go to sleep, little baby. You know that lullaby?
Oh, yeah.
I recognize
the lullaby
that.
Lullaby
right? Set. Is that what it's called?
Yep, lullaby set.
Okay, so yeah, that's just what it is. So some of it that being licensed anyway. But it's just all good. It's all really good.
Yeah, there was about 8 licensed tracks in the entire game. And like, it's great because it all seems like it fits this game and this world so perfectly that I can't really complain too much about it. Mm-hmm.
So Josh, I feel like we've gushed very long and very loud about the story, but this is a game. So let's talk about some gameplay really quick. It would only be fair. What was your favorite level or at least your favorite mechanic in this game?
Honestly, the World 2 was probably my favorite. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that I was like, okay, this game is going to be just like Mario and Prince of Persia put together. If I have an issue, I can kind of rewind, which that mechanic's been put into a lot of games more recently. I just noticed it with the Mega Man collection, where you're actually able to go back and kind of rewind the game if you screwed up something. I think that it's nice that they've kind of incorporated that into more games, but putting it into this one, that's what my favorite level was, because that's what I had the mindset going in that this whole game was going to be, and then it progressively kept getting harder and more difficult. I mentioned it earlier in the game, World 4 was just atrocious. That had me pulling my hair out, that it was just so, I was like, this game is not smarter than me. Like, what am I missing? Just the whole going forward and time goes forward, going backwards and time goes back. Like, I was like, this, like, I'm not stupid.
You're not gonna pick on me, game.
Yeah. What about you, Tom?
I really enjoyed World 3, where they introduced the concept of certain items being resistant to the flow of time, whether it be keys or platforms. And I think it culminates in a really interesting way at one point where you yourself can become invincible to the flow of your own time. Like, you can trigger the reverse, but you stay in one spot in order to like get through a trap door. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. I like that mechanic a lot. My least favorite moment of this entire game was in World 4 also. It's a puzzle called Fickle Companion. And basically, when you pick up a key and you're walking forward, the key will move with you. But if you start walking backwards, the key separates from you and it'll float all over the level to any place you've previously been.
Yep.
And you have to basically navigate all the doors by giving the key to certain enemies and letting them walk for you and stuff. And that took me forever and I hated it. And drove me up a wall. I mean, it's that's some ingenious design to sit there and plot all that out. Good for Jonathan Blow for on his own programming that and, you know, designing that. Oh, but I wanted to bash my head off the wall.
No, the mechanics to this game are absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. For how frustrating they can be, the fact that one man thought of these ideas by himself, just bravo.
And like, let it be said, when I did solve a puzzle, I felt great. You know, it's a very rewarding game. You put your brain to the test, and then when you solve the puzzles, you feel awesome, you know?
Yeah, it's very similar to like the Portal games. Like, they can be, some of those puzzles can be a little bit more time consuming and frustrating at times, but when you figure it out, you feel so accomplished when you're done with it.
Yes, very good challenge to satisfaction ratio, in my opinion.
So, Tom, do you still recommend Braid after 10 years of being out in the market?
Absolutely. Braid is probably one of the best indie games ever, and it's got so many unique items to it, and it's such a unique challenge. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to get a great platforming challenge that'll kind of sharpen your skills and give you an appreciation for the genre, this is an excellent title. Great soundtrack, excellent marriage between thematic ideas and gameplay. It's good. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I would still recommend this game. I think it is one of those games, like I said, from me growing up, this game made me appreciate games as art. From everything from the watercolored artwork inside this game to the music to the story to kind of sitting there at the end with the controller in my hand thinking, did that just happen? Like, did what I think just happened actually happen in the game? Like, because like I said, you go into that final world or World 1 and everything's backwards. And then all of a sudden everything starts going forwards. And then you kind of forget that final world is going backwards the entire time, that when things are fixed and things are right, like, you're getting told a completely different story. And I think it's something, yeah, we kind of went through and spoiled a lot of this, but for people to go through and read all the journal entries and find all the hidden journal entries and maybe find all the stars or whatnot and kind of interpret the game their own way, many people are going to have different ideas of what happened in this game and what happened in all of these worlds itself. I would love for this game to get put out onto the Switch so I can play it again portably. I can hook up my Xbox if I wanted to play it, but like, this is one of those games that you want, kind of want to take with you to kind of like digest it over time.
Absolutely. Love it.
Well, that's all the time that we can spend in the past, so thanks for listening. Subscribe to A Cast of the Past on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And stay up to date with A Cast of the Past by making sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you can be the first to know when new episodes drop, as well as joining in on discussions on all things gaming. And until next time, we'll see you in the future.